off and the clock has started.
Here we go.
Greetings, everybody. My name is Doug Prazak, and welcome to episode 139 of 20 Minutes You'll Never Get Back. It's actually going to be like maybe 23 minutes you're never going to get back, because it's kind of a longer episode today, but you know, I apologize. Also, you notice it's just me. There's no announcer, no voiceover, anything. It's just me, so we'll see how it goes. We're going to start right off, as we always do, say hi to a couple places that tuned in last episode. Barrie, Ontario, Canada. That's new to my list. Aldie, Virginia, and Noblesville, Indiana. But alas, nobody from Edenton heard me finally pronounce Edenton the proper way. That's just sad. And if Edenton is listening to this episode, please go back and listen to episode 138, or at least the first 5 minutes, because the nice recording at your City Hall phone number there taught me how to say Edenton. As I said, this is going to be a bit of a long episode, so I want to get right into it. Now, you certainly saw that the title of this episode is Not Gonna Happen. And you're probably already asking yourself, what does that mean, Doug? Well, it means, my friends, that these are things that could involve me that are just not gonna happen. Now, let me explain. I saw a TV commercial that included someone jumping out of an airplane and parachuting down to terra firma. It's for some gum commercial. I don't know. It doesn't make any difference. They jumped out of an airplane. And I said to myself, yeah, that's not gonna happen. That obviously then got me to thinking,
uh-oh,
what else wouldn't I do? Now, before I dive into, that's a joke. I didn't even realize it was a joke. Before I dive into this, let me say this. For the millions of you out there who have a psychotic need to do crazy stuff like jump out of an airplane, good for you. You be you, okay? You're insane, but good for you. And that includes members of my own family. Now, I came up with 5 things that other people do. Things I consider crazy, stupid things. Things which are not going to happen. Some of you may agree with me, and most of you will label me with names like a type of a willow tree. That's okay. I'm not hurt, especially because I won't be jumping out of an airplane. These 5 activities are apparently common activities to many, or at least 4 out of 5 are. The 5th one is just kind of out there. There's nothing like, petting a rattlesnake or giving a gorilla a bath. No, none of those are just common. But because this podcast is classified as educational, who's buying that? It's educational. I'm going to give you a brief history of these potential deadly activities and perhaps some statistics about, well, the last time you tried any of these things. So I'll start where it began, skydiving. The Chinese attempted parachuting in the 10th century. Now, of course, there were no airplanes, so the Chinese did what would today be called base diving. That is, they jumped off of outcroppings or other formations like that. They used rigid parasols that would allow them to float from a height down to the ground. There's no video how this actually happened. We'll have to take their word for it. But the skydiving we know today is more closely related to a Frenchman named Jacques Garnerin. Someday I'm going to learn French. Someday. He became famous in 1797 when he jumped from a basket suspended under a balloon with a parachute, all for a show. His first official parachute jump technically qualified as a skydive, as it was over Paris from 2,000 feet. It took almost 100 years for the activity to hit the United States, and in 1885 in San Francisco, Thomas Scott Baldwin was the first person in the United States to descend from a balloon in a parachute. Now, this sport, if you want to call it that, I don't know why you would, but eventually transitioned from balloons as base platforms to airplanes. In 1911, Grant Morton made the first parachute jump from an airplane at Venice Beach, California. Morton's parachute was the throw-out type. he held the chute in his arms. Then as he jumped out the plane, he threw it out. Oh, my God. On March 1st, 1912, U.S. Army Captain Albert Barrie made the first parachute jump from a moving aircraft over Missouri using a pack-style chute that we know today. In the mid-1950s, Raymond Young was the, and I hope you're writing all these names down because there will be a test later. In the mid-1950s, Raymond Young was the first to use the word skydiver to describe the sport. Commercial skydiving centers and schools began to pop up throughout the 1960s. Typical jump altitudes in modern times for experienced skydivers range from 7,500 to 15,000 feet above ground level, with a free fall time of between 40 and 85 seconds. I'm sorry. It means you got 40 seconds watching the earth come plummeting towards your face. God. Free fall speeds for skydivers falling belly to earth. You know, you're laying out there and just flat as a pancake coming down. They range from 110 to 130 miles an hour. Let me get this straight here, okay? You decide you're going to get into an airplane. You're going to fly up to, 15,000 feet, jump out, and for 85 seconds, you're traveling 130 miles an hour, watching the earth come towards you. Oh, my God. There's not enough underwear in the world for me. But just how safe is skydiving, you ask? Well, many think that equipment failure causes the most skydiving accidents. But in reality, the vast majority are a result of simple human error in judgment. Like getting in an airplane. Each parachute system is equipped with a main and reserve parachute, and all student systems include an automatic activation device, which is an electric device that will release the reserve chute if the main chute does not deploy. An estimated 12% of the United States Parachute Association members reported using their reserve parachute in 2023. 12%! That means 12% of the big one didn't open up. Oh my God! 6% of the members reported that they experienced an injury that required medical treatment in 2023, the most common being ankle injuries from landings. In 2023, the USPA members reported making 3.6 million skydives. In the same year, there were a total of 10 civilian skydiving fatalities in the United States. Now, when you round the numbers and put them into an index calculated at, say, 100,000 jumps, the 2023 number is 0.27 deaths per 100,000 jumps. So based on that statistic, it appears, and just appears, that the odds are on your side for a safe jump, okay? I mean, 0.27 after 100,000 jumps, okay, still not going to happen. Now, while thousands and thousands of skydiving jumps are made every day, I am sure... Now, make that I am positive that the time I would ever try this, it would end with me taking out my medical card. Guaranteed. But again, for all of you who really enjoy jumping out of an airplane and plummeting towards Earth, I applaud you. The next thing that's not going to happen is bungee jumping. Now, if you are unaware, bungee jumping is a sport where the jumper falls from a high place with basically a thick rubber band called a bungee that's attached to a platform and to their feet. The adrenaline junkie, or jumper, free falls head first and then is bounced back partway when the cord rebounds from its maximum stretch. So how did all this start? Who thought this would be a good idea? Well, bungee jumping traces its roots to the land diving that was practiced on the Pentecost Island in Vanuatu. Divers there would jump off of a high tower with their feet connected to it by a vine. And here's the fun part, okay? The vine's length is calculated to allow the jumper to fall until his hair just brushes the ground below. Often land divers hit the ground, but the vines absorb sufficient force to make the impact non-lethal. All right, so I think we need about 15 and a half inches of vine. Oops. The Oxford Dangerous Sports Club, that sounds like a club I will not be joining anytime soon. The Oxford Dangerous Sports Club, they were inspired by reports of the Pentecost Island divers. In 1979, David Kirk and Simon Keeling made the first modern bungee jumps from the Clifton Suspension Bridge in Bristol, England, at a height of 250 feet, or 76 meters for the rest of the world. The jumpers were arrested shortly after, but continued with jumps in the United States from the Golden Gate Bridge and the Royal Gorge Bridge. By 1982, Kirk and Keeling were jumping from mobile cranes and hot air balloons. See? Came back full circle, jumping from a balloon. The first organized commercial bungee jumping began with New Zealander A.J. Hackett, who made his first jump from Auckland's Greenhithe Bridge in 1986. All right, well, what about the risk of injury, you ask? We can start by talking to the land divers in Pentecost Island. Well, a lot of the accidents happened when the participants became detached from the bungee. Well, you can kind of figure out what the injury is when you're jumping off a bridge and you become detached from the bungee. I don't suspect it ends very well. That led to many commercial operators to use a body harness as basically a backup to the ankle attachment. Well, that was really nice of them. Injuries that occur despite these safety measures generally relate to the bungee cord recoil. Eyesight damage is the most frequently reported complication. Now again, if you thrill seekers out there like jumping off a bridge attached by a hair tie on steroids, have fun. As for Doug, sorry, not going to happen. But this next activity has an 87% or higher chance of injury. 87%! The one that's absolutely not going to happen for me is running down a narrow cobbled street being chased by a herd of pissed off bulls. That's right. It's the running of the bulls at the Festival de San Fermín in Pamplona, Spain. Will I be there? Nope. Do I have some history about it? Yep. The event has its origins in the old practice of transporting bulls from the fields outside the city to the bull ring. The bulls previously running around in the daytime would be in the bullfights that night, where they would be up against matadors who have, well, swords and knives, and you can figure out the rest. During this run, local youths would jump among them in a display of bravado. Spanish tradition says that the bull running began in northeastern Spain in the early 14th century. Cattle herders who wanted to transport their animals from barges or from the countryside to the city centers for sale or bullfights needed an easy way to move their precious animals. While transporting cattle in order to sell them to the market, men would try and speed up the process by hurrying the cattle along using tactics of fear and excitement. After years of practice, the transportation and hurrying began to turn into a competition, as young adults would attempt to race in front of the bulls and make it safely to their pens without being overtaken. When the popularity of this practice increased and was noticed more and more by the expanding population in the Spanish cities, a tradition was created, and it stands to this day. In the mornings, visitors head to the safety of their running of the bulls balcony spots, or, for the boldest, to the route's entrance to the run. A first rocket is set off at 8 a.m. to alert the runners that the corral gate is open. A second rocket signals that all bulls have been released. Each day during the festival, some 2,000, yeah, you heard me, 2,000 people crowd themselves onto the narrow cobbled streets and then literally run for their lives on the half-mile run, or 875 meters for the rest of the world. Speaking of running for their lives, according to the Pamplona officials, hundreds of runners are injured annually during this dangerous event. You think? Many suffer minor scrapes or grazes, while others need emergency medical treatment for life-threatening injuries. Pamplona bull run deaths are rare, but since 1910, when record-keeping began, 16 people have died. Gorings cause the most Pamplona bull run fatalities. The second most common cause of death for runners is being struck by the horns, which often leads to massive head and brain injury. Besides being tossed in the air by the sharp horns of half-ton bulls, runners also face another formidable threat, the risk of a pileup. One runner goes down, the rest go down on top of that, and then here come the bulls. Now, if you've done this and you're still able to hear this show, then I say good for you. And then I ask, why on earth would you do that? Some people, like you and me, we go out in nature and wonder in its beauty, the forests, the waterfalls, the sheer cliffs. Others say, I think I'll go climb that sheer cliff today. F gravity. In ancient times, rock climbing was not recreational. It was a practical necessity. People were hunters and gatherers, and some of the game and food sources that need to hunt and gather were located in areas that required climbing. Some ancient cultures considered high places like a mountain peak or cliffs as sacred or spiritually significant. In times of conflict, people sought elevated positions for defensive strategies, and they had to climb up there. But that was then, and this is now. And for some unknown reason, all right, those of you who do it have a reason, I guess. albeit a flawed reason, but that's just me. Anyway, rock climbing is a sport. The earliest recorded instances of rock climbing can be traced back to China and Europe in the late 1800s, where mountaineers began to explore steep and challenging rock faces in an effort to summit the peaks. Climbers used primitive equipment such as hemp ropes and wooden pegs, and then they often relied on their own physical strength and skill, so that's why I'm not doing it, to overcome these obstacles. This era of climbing is known as the Golden Age of Alpinism. As the sport of rock climbing evolved, so did the equipment and techniques used by climbers. In the 1930s, German climber Fritz Wiesner introduced the use of expansion bolts, which allowed climbers to safely anchor themselves to the rock face. In the 1950s, American climbers began to push the limits of what was possible on big walls such as El Capitan in Yosemite Valley. If you've never seen El Capitan, it's magnificent, but I digress. These climbers were known for their bold and often controversial tactics, which included drilling holes in the rock and using fixed ropes to aid their ascents. This era of climbing is known as the Golden Age of Yosemite. I think I see a trend happening here. It marked the turning point in the sport as climbers began to focus more on free climbing, which is climbing without the use of aid. Well, that is just stupid. By the 1960s, the sport of rock climbing had become increasingly popular and new climbing areas began to spring up all over the world. Climbers were making headlines for their ambitious and daring ascents in the Himalayas and the Alps. This era of climbing is known as the Golden Age of Himalayan climbing. In the 1970s, climbing gyms began to appear, providing indoor training and climbing opportunities for climbers. This was known as the Golden Age of Indoor Climbing because you didn't want to fall from a cliff. Rock climbing is not without the danger of injury, or worse. Climbing injuries are usually caused by overtraining or by a traumatic injury like torn ligaments or fractures. The overall rock climbing fatality rate in the United States is 3.3 per 100,000 participants, which, if we recall numbers, is greater than skydiving. In 2019, El Capitan and Yosemite Park witnessed 6 deaths, which is the highest number of fatalities recorded. Once again, if you love to rock climb, do it, but just be careful. As for me, I will stand at the bottom of El Capitan and enjoy gravity from 6 feet. And lastly, here's the fifth thing of something that's just not going to happen. It doesn't involve any sort of gravity-defying activity or ropes or chutes or anything. No, what's not going to happen is me eating, or specifically cooking, pufferfish. Pufferfish have the ability to rapidly fill their belly with air or water, and it expands like a balloon to 2 or 3 times their normal size. This increase in size to an awkward shape makes them pretty unattractive to potential predators. Puffers are clumsy swimmers, and they can't wriggle around and dart through the water, so they must use their fins to paddle around. Rather than speed, they rely on this puffing ability as a defense mechanism. But this particular behavior isn't the puffer's only means of defense. Most puffers are toxic to eat. There is enough poison in one pufferfish to kill 30 adult humans. Their internal organs produce a neurotoxin called tetrodotoxin. This neurotoxin has no antidote. It can cause paralysis, seizures, and death. To humans, tetrodotoxin is deadly, up to 1,200 times more poisonous than cyanide. And these are all really good reasons why I will not eat a pufferfish. Now, to many, though, pufferfish is a delicacy. Pufferfish, how many times can I say pufferfish? Good God. Pufferfish is also known as fugu. Fugu meat is considered a refined and luxurious dish. Since 1958, fugu chefs must earn a license to prepare and sell fugu to the public. This involves a 2 to 3 year apprenticeship. The licensing examination process consists of a written test, a fish identification test, a practical test, and preparing and eating the fish. Now, I keenly remember some tests I took in college that I thought were a slam dunk A+, and they turned out to be a massive failure. So a test of preparing and eating a deadly fish certainly could end up being a final exam. Only about 35% of the applicants pass. I'd like to know at what point the other 65 failed. Jesus, I hope it was during the written part. One small miscalculation in the cooking part and, well, you're dead. Consumers believe that this training process makes it safer to eat fugu in restaurants or markets. Oh, hell no. I'm sorry. And finally, only a dozen U.S. chefs are licensed to serve it. And currently, only 17 restaurants in the United States are licensed to serve fugu. And there you go. 5 things that are not gonna happen. And that will wrap up episode 139. But first, what did we learn? Well, we learned that Doug is one giant gravity-adverse wuss. That's right, I own it. I don't care. There is no reason to get an airplane, fly at 15,000 feet, and then jump out. I would rather not tie a rubber band around my ankles than jump off a bridge. I have the utmost respect for bullhorns. I'll just take the picture of El Capitan, and there is no fugu-ing way I will ever eat a pufferfish. Call me what you want. I'm okay with that. And in exchange, if you partake in any of those aforementioned activities, I'll just call you crazy. Fair enough? That's it. Thank you very much for tuning in and listening. I appreciate it as always. And I'll talk to you next time on 20 Minutes You'll Never Get Back. Bye-bye. Oh, yeah, there's one more thing that's never going to happen. Me playing pickleball. Hi, it's me again, Doug. I want to take up a couple more seconds of your time just to remind you, if you want to stay informed of when the next podcast is posted, all you need to do is sign up at on that Instagram machine. It's at 20MYNGB, 20MYNGB, and that means 20 minutes you'll never get back. If you sign up there, you'll always see when the next podcast is uploaded. And if you want to leave some comments, by all means, please do go to the website at 20minutespodcast.com. So it's 20minutespodcast.com. And you can leave your comments there. It also tells you how you can be an announcer for the show. So take a look at those two things if you'd like and stay informed. And as always, thank you very much for listening to 20 Minutes You'll Never Get Back. Bye-bye.